and down this road the rest of your life. Burr heard him, listened hard, and what Lonnie said sounded reasonable. Reasonable, at least, to a boy whose daddy and granddaddy and great-granddaddy had rented land from men like Lonnie, and whose mama would die in a rocking chair, him and dungarees, smelling like bleach and Argo starch. He just listened and agreed. Marry Tiny Fran, whether you did it or not, just marry her, and take a 48-acre block, a good piece, drains good, not clay dirt, good loamy soil. Marry her and have something. So what do you do? If she'd lived in town, it could have been somebody saying, marry the town whore and I'll give you Main Street, all up and down both sides, all the stores, all the things in the stores, Main Street. Burr said he didn't miss a beat. I'll do it, Lonnie. I like Tiny Fran okay. But the fact was, he thought the same about her everybody did. More times than a plenty, I'd be out in the tractor yard with him, and we'd see Tiny Fran go across the yard and something poured on looking, and he'd do his made-up rhyme. Between Franny's thighs is where her fanny lies, and that's what makes my britches rise. So, you see, he didn't think she is okay. You generally don't marry somebody you feel like you can tease about like that. He wasn't an innocent lamb with blinders on, led, not knowing what all he might be in for with a girl like her. I just don't believe he had a clear idea how much and how long he'd have to pay. I always heard paybacks is hell. Sorry as she was, though, I cannot honestly say I'd have turned her down if she'd have been offered to me. That's a lot of property. And it's a lot of ways you can think up to stay out from under a woman. Stay drunk, stay at work, stay in front of the television set. But I did turn down one piece of property, Ruby's she got when her parents died. I said, I can't take it, Ruby, I can't take your land. And she said, it's not mine. I told her, it's got your name on it. And she told me that was all that made it hers. I knew how she felt. She'd talked to me before, and it wasn't so much like I felt like I'd be cashing in on marrying somebody with money. I'd wanted her before I knew what she'd come from. I just didn't want a place I didn't know. I know this place. Not taking the land was a choice I and Ruby had to make, and after we made it, we just had to close the door. And I act like Burr was out there in that field with a choice, but he wasn't. He saw all that land he'd wanted and his daddy'd wanted, and it wasn't a choice at all. That sun hitting the hill where his acres would start must have been the best-looking thing he'd ever seen, except for his dream woman. But she is in his head, and she'd have to stay there. Go ahead. Say how trading a happy life for land is foolish, how your peace of mind is more important than a piece of fertile land. But let me tell you this, when you grow up out here, when you know your family's been here long as theirs, meaning somebody like Alani Hoover, when you know you can match time with them day for day, year for year, all this stretched out beside the road, back to the woods, farther and farther, it pure hurts sometimes to look at it. Looking at it after all that time you spent with your face so close down on it over a bean row, touching it, turning it over, then going home to not one damn thing that's yours, but some clothes and some pots and pans and a stick or two of furniture. Let's say Burr's family rented from Lonnie's crowd 100 years. That's a long time, especially when it looks to you like the whole rest of the world is drawing interest and all you're doing is putting in sweat and taking out the tired frustration. Then, something comes along like Lonnie's bad situation that can end it, and you and the rest of your line can have something, even if it is on account of what some teenage whore did one afternoon in the corn crib with God knows who or how many. That's one way of stopping what's going on. School's another way. Burr's girl June got a college degree, but what do you think would have been her chance if Burr hadn't told Lonnie he'd marry his girl? Not much. She'd have either been a tiny Fran, or swung back the other way around and been head over heels into the church down there and worried the pure living hell out of somebody wanting to witness all the time. Or she might would could have joined the 4-H and spent all her time dragging a calf around out here. But she got off from this place, had a mind to do something. You have to get off somewhere to do something, make some money. If she'd been born with her daddy still renting, she'd still be here. And we'd all look at her all the time and think how that's a shame with her so smart. No, you need something of your own. And you need it young so you can enjoy having it. Not look back on all the work and wish you weren't so damn tired all the time with not a thing to show for it, but your memory of working. But Burr was lucky. Hard a time as he had had managing Tiny Fran, he's told me he felt like he made out pretty good. He told me that a piece of something, the land, he said what that gives a man is two things, some pride and some time. And you can sit back if you've a mind to and look outside and see all those folks hunched over picking, digging, pulling up out of your dirt, setting something back down in it, doing all the things you used to do, save for the grace of Lonnie Hoover. He died this fall, be 10 years ago. Lost the left side of his head, then next thing you know, he's gone. I told Ruby, I said, I hate to say it, but I'll be glad to finally see what Lonnie has down in his will. I knew he had one, a man with as much business as he had has to. I don't. I'll die interstate, nothing to pass on and no heirs. Ruby's cancer ate up most everything we had saved, and if it hadn't been for her brothers picking up what they did, I don't think we'd have made it. Everything's a goddamn high. But I figured Lonnie'd have things squared away. Sometimes I don't know why I think things. But I thought for damn sure he'd have sat in Lawyer Peel's office and said to him, "Well, I've got this one tenant been with my family long as I can remember. Worked hard, never showed up drunk, never asked to borrow money. Good man. I think I might let him have that piece he's been living on since he was born." And I thought if it didn't happen like that, then at least he'd remember standing beside me in that field, and both of us boys, and seeing his daddy's tractor kill my daddy. Kill him right out here in this field next to my house. Oh, but hell no. Neither thing counted. Ruby'd tell me, "Try not to be bitter. Lonnie didn't know all you've been thinking." After she'd talked to me, I'd feel better, and then her calming me down would wear off, and I'd have to get out of the house and go out to the animal shelter and sit out there until I was so drunk I couldn't see straight, much less think. See, it was I and Daddy and Lonnie and his daddy Henry and all these farmers from up and down the road all standing at the edge of the field looking at Henry's new tractor. Nobody'd ever seen one except in the Progressive Farmer, and sure as hell couldn't afford one. But you can bet if it was big and new, Henry'd beg, borrow, or steal for it. And there it was, big, red, and somebody said, "Show us what it'll do." Henry told Daddy to hop up there and take it down a row. He'd been on it all morning, so I didn't think anything of it. But what did bother me was Henry. See, he could have driven it himself, but what he was doing was he was letting Daddy do it so he could stand there with all his buddies and see everything they were seeing. Not just the new tractor, but the field and the tractor and a man he could say this and that to in order to manage both things for him. He was one white man that loved to watch another one work. So Daddy took the tractor down a row, and Henry stood by us with his arms crossed, and Lonnie stood next to him with his arms crossed, just like his daddy's. And then Daddy got to the other end and started to make a turn, and I remember thinking, he's too close to the ditch, too close. Then the whole business turned over nice and easy, like it was the most natural thing in the world for that tractor to fold over into that drainage ditch. We all ran down there, but it wasn't a thing we could do. But I can still feel my arms ache for how hard I pulled at that tractor. Somebody pulled me away and told me, he said, only somebody mightier than us all could lift it, meaning God. And I felt like screaming right out in that field, is this how you treat the ones that love you? My daddy might have been a son of a bitch sometimes, but he did evermore love the Lord. But Lonnie didn't make things square, and here I sit, old as the hills I've farmed since I could hold a plow line, sitting here by myself, too. Land and children, they're the only things in this world that'll carry on for you. And here I am, going to my grave without either one.
I've heard television evangelists say the Lord will return when you least expect him. I think I was afraid that same prophecy might have applied to John Woodrow those nights he didn't come home. I said to myself, about the time I get used to him being gone, when I've calmed down, returned the pistol, that'll be when he comes in slobbering all over me wanting to kiss and make up. Or either that'll be when the screen door blows open like almighty hell breaking loose and he'll come in pulling that dazed young girl behind him. And if and when push came to shove, I saw myself pulling that pistol from under my pillow and saying, so what do you think about little Miss Vanderbilt now? I remember I slept with my clothes on the 3 nights he was missing, and each morning before I went to the Hoover's, I'd change and take a little spit bath, the kind Mama would have allowed only if I was sick. That third day I went to work was the day I met Jack. I was waiting under the big tree in the backyard, waiting for somebody, either Tiny Fran or her mother, to come out and tell me to come on in. You didn't dare just show up and knock on the door, be it the front or back door. And I saw a skinny man with his dungarees all hung around his hips, swerving, trying to manage a tall load of manure, headed across the yard toward me. He was 40 then, but he looked 10 years older. All that time out in the sun had dried and pulled his skin. He says he's never minded it, that he's not what he calls a town man, trying to stay young and fresh despite the odds. He's always said it's fine for women to trick time with lotions and whatnot, because the trick poured off just right, he says, is really something to look at, smell of, touch. I know he's referring to me. I know I'm every bit of his experience. But he pushed his wheelbarrow right up to me that day like approaching young women waiting under pecan trees was something he did every day, like it was something he regularly did on the way from the chicken house to the garden. I wasn't afraid at all by the way he looked at me, not like the way I felt when I'd stand up from picking and see the crew chief staring. Jack's look was more like what happens when I'm walking from here to the store and the sun catches something on the side of that road just right, and I wonder if it's a dime or a piece of jewelry, but then I know nobody out here has any jewelry to lose, so I pick the dime up, rub the dirt off, look at it hard, hard as I'd look if it'd been a brooch, just because I'd found it, and finding anything of value is unusual, be it a dime or a man with clay-red skin or a young woman resting under a pecan tree. And this is the first thing my husband ever said to me. He said, this is something, you smoking a cigarette and at 90-some-odd degrees out here. He can burn through right to the heart of a thing. But I'd about had it with men and their opinions of me, so I told him it was my business how hot I was. Then he set the load down and said to me, well, if it's your business, I reckon it's your business. I just smoked my cigarette and watched him. I thought he was sure to say something else just as curious. He stood there and watched me, too, and then he wanted to know who I was, what I was doing under Lonnie's tree, how long I'd been there, if I was with the migrants, if I was married. He got all those questions out before I could think up answers to any. I told him the truth to everything except the migrant question. I said I was traveling with them doing research. I think he knew I was lying, but he didn't say anything and never has. After I answered the question about being married, he wanted to know who to, and I told him, and that was a dead giveaway. But I didn't back down. I just hoped he wouldn't ask me anything else. I said, I'm married to John Woodrow. He's one of the workers, but see, I met him at the beginning of my research. He's a great help with my work. The more I talked, the deeper in I got. When I stopped, he thought for a minute and said, John Woodrow, he's that one they found cut up last night. You can't imagine what was going through my head. I told him to tell me everything he knew. He said it might upset me, but I told him to please go on and tell me. So he told me Lonnie had gotten a call late that night before from the sheriff, and that he'd had to get up and go to town to the hospital in the jailhouse. Apparently what happened was John Woodrow left that girl and her baby somewhere and got up with some of his drinking buddies, the sorriest of the sorriest, as Jack would call them, and they all went to a pool hall in town, and one thing led to another, and they all got in a drunk fight with some other sorriness, and when all was said and done, one was in jail, one was missing, and John Woodrow was in the hospital. The sheriff figured they were migrants, and he knew Lonnie had just gotten a new crew in, so he called him, and sure enough, they were his. He said word wasn't out yet, that the crew chief probably didn't know, more than likely wouldn't care. He said Lonnie wouldn't have cared except that it aggravated him to have to get up and go to town in the middle of the night. Jack also told me I should come to his house if I needed him for anything, and he pointed it out to me across the field. When he said needed and anything, I knew he meant food, money, somewhere to rest a while. And then he told me his name, his whole name, the way he enjoys saying it. Stokes the fire, stokes the stove, stokes the fiery furnace of hell. Tiny Fran interrupted us, calling me inside to find her blessed crackers. At first I thought she might have something nasty to say about John Woodrow being hurt, but then I realized she wouldn't associate me with the mess at all, if her daddy even mentioned it in the house. I didn't have a last name there. I was just Ruby or that girl. So I decided to use that time of nobody knowing to rest in and gather up what strength I'd need when everything came at me, when all those workers would turn their petty curiosity on me. I just turned it all off. All I'd ever heard from John Woodrow was how ignorant I was. So I said, fine, I'm ignorant of the fix he's in. Word of his injury soon traveled up one tobacco row and down the next, and by the time the workers came into the yard that afternoon, it seemed like every one of them knew exactly how many stitches he'd had, how deep the cuts were, and how his lung was punctured in such and such a place. Walking to the house afterwards, a woman who'd never spoken to me came up and patted my arm and said, "I hear your man got cut real bad, might not make it." She waited for me to touch her back or maybe break down, but I didn't. I was so ticked off, all I could say to her was, "That's what they tell me." She snapped her hand off me and fell in with her friends, and I could hear her tell them how insensitive I was, and with John Woodrow laid up in the hospital, cut up and about to hardly make it. I knew they thought I'd be doing the wifely thing to sit by John Woodrow and swab his wounds just because, all because he was my man. I'd nursed Jack all day and night, but that's a different story. And while they walked on, I slipped back and crossed a wide ditch and stood on the edge of the wheat field, wondering if I should wade across to Jack's house. But I didn't go. I just stayed on the edge there and looked at his house. This house. I had no idea it'd be my house 5 months from then. And after a long time of purely standing and staring, wondering about my whole big mess, I crossed back over the ditch and went home. When I got there, I found the pistol and put it at the bottom of my bag, way down under where my lingerie had been. I'd never see those nice things again, but I still hear the pistol. That night, after I'd eaten supper, Jack came to see me. I remember him standing at the screen door, and I could smell him. He smelled like a soap, a sweet soap. And he said, "I hate to be the one to have to tell you, but your husband passed a little while ago." He paused a minute and then said, "It was the lungs. They wouldn't stay up, is what Lonnie told me." And the very next thought I had was how I was alone. Not John Woodrow's dead, ding dong, John Woodrow's dead. I was glad to have Jack stay there with me while I cried everything out of my system. Sometimes I think the smart thing to have done would have been to pack right up and go home fast as I could, call Daddy and have him come for me, but I couldn't. I hadn't just stayed out all night and was nervous about walking into breakfast. This wasn't anything like that, like knowing that everything would blow over by lunch and by dinner time, you'd be one of them again, forgiven, everything back in its place, including you. Where was my place there? I wasn't a son, not a boy who could come home and fall into plowing or mowing a field and earn his way back into his home. I was a daughter who'd mainly watched men work a farm from a kitchen window. And I can't even say I did my part inside, the woman's work, and let the men manage the outside. But I wasn't helpless, just useless. See, I had it in the back of my mind that one day I'd have somebody like Sudie B to help me, and I'd be able to pass for a grown woman or the lady of the house. Somebody like Sudie B covers for people. Having her in my kitchen would have been no different from those commercials you see where the husband says, "Mm-mm, this sure is good cake. Tastes like you made it from scratch." And the wife just winks at the camera and wiggles the mix box behind her back. It's not any different from that at all. Mom had basted a turkey that Sudie B had chased, caught, killed, scalded, everything. She tapped more salt into the pan dressing Sudie B had made, and I'd come in when everything was basted, salted, and garnished the turkey, put the napkins in rings. I'd put finishing touches on Mama's finishing touches. I was twice removed from the real work, far away from Mama stooped over a roasting pan basting butter on the turkey, and even farther away from Sudie B running around the chicken yard with an axe in her hand. I spent many a frustrating hour learning how to cook, trying to remember how Sudie B had done things, but mostly making things up as I went along. Poor Jack had to choke down a few dry mouthfuls before I can even make a recipe come out. Cooking's not like cleaning. You don't just know what good is and then cook it. You need a touch that comes with time and patience, especially if you grew up playing the piano while meals were being prepared and then coming into the kitchen just in time to put parsley on the plates. But you ought to see the way I've kept this house and cooked for Jack. I'm sorry to say that I might not have much in my life to be proud of, but I'm surely pleased with myself every time I see bread rise, and it rises every time. I don't hear shots anymore. He's finished. I have to be, too, for now. Sometimes it's easier to stop thinking about things than others, but then how many people do you know who are able to get off a loop as easily as they got on it? Daydreaming, loving the wrong man, smoking, all habits hard to break.
The night before Burr and Tiny Fran got married, I didn't sleep not one wink, worrying, worrying, worrying. I worried about it all. I ought to have slept, though, as hard as Francis had run me all week. Do this, do that. Get me busy as a one-armed paper hanger, pruning the hedge bushes, arranging pine straw, cleaning out the chicken house. By the time Saturday rolled around, I was so tired I thought I might liable not be able to stand up for Burr. But I did. Pissed Francis off, too, me standing up front at the wedding. I know it did, but I didn't give a whit. That was I and Burr's business. He's like a son to me. About all I had to look forward to at that wedding, besides being Burr's best man, was seeing Ruby. We'd been hanging right tight since John Woodrow died. There wasn't anybody else there I gave a happy hoorah about. Like all Francis's out-of-town family, they didn't have the slightest notion what was going on that day. Burr told me they had the impression him and Tiny Fran had been courting a fair amount of time. Now I wonder where they got that. And you can damn well bet old preacher What's-His-Face from down at Ephesus wouldn't have anything to do with it. He'd gotten wind of the mess from somebody at Porter's store, and he wasn't touching it. They had to bring in a civil somebody. And I could have put another dollar down on Burr's mom and daddy not showing up. I know they both stayed shut up in the house all day. His daddy probably worrying the tar out of Burr the whole time he was trying to get his clothes on. Burr's daddy, Leon, was a mealy-mouthed son of a bitch if there ever was one. Same age as me. Always treated me like I didn't have enough sense to pour piss out of a boot with the instructions on the heel. He'd go around out here with his big old cigar in his mouth, smiling like Franklin D. Roosevelt, acting he as happy as could be to be a poor, dumb old working man, but you knew it was the opposite true. Then he'd go home at night and beat his wife. Beat Burr, too. And then poor Pansy died like she did, up sewing in the middle of the night. He used to go sit at the store, rear back, rub that great big belly of his and say, "Well, I tell you, I might be just a poor old working man, but I got the sense to see Lonnie Hoover might ought to sell that hay for a dime or a bale if he expects to turn a profit on it." Or, "Nobody's going to ask me what I think about it, me being just a poor working man, but if they did, I'd tell them Lonnie might ought not to plant that back field with fescue again this year." You wanted to say to him, "That's right, nobody gives a damn what you think, so shut up." But it wasn't worth the air. You just rolled your eyes. And then his only boy marries a Hoover and gets that backfield, and now he's one of the ones that's not going to ask Leon his opinion. After Burr got married, I remember how Leon had his heart attack and they laid him out. I went with Burr and stood there with him looking in the casket, and he told me, he said, "All my daddy ever wanted was a nice suit of clothes, a fine automobile, and some respect." Burr had bought a $150 suit to bury him in. Leon would have set fire to it if Burr had offered it to him while he was living, bad as his mouth would have been watering for it. And then I and Burr went to the Buick place, and he got a little model automobile and went back to the funeral home, slipped it in beside Leon where nobody'd spot it and have a time with it. Then I said to Burr, "Burr, he's got the fine suit of clothes and a brand new Buick. I guess a nice service will have to do for the respect." Then he told me his daddy got respect. He knew he'd gotten it because it was something he'd beat him into telling him all the whole time he was growing up. No wonder he didn't go to the boy's wedding. He must have been pure eat up with jealousy. But on back, I got to the house and Ruby was running a dust rag in the living room, and I asked her how about if we went to my house and cooked supper after all the commotion was over. She was just learning how to cook then, and she liked to try out things on me. But while we were standing there, we heard Francis in the next room telling Lonnie how that little girl in there, meaning Ruby, wanted to act like she is better than somebody. Said she'd snubbed her when she'd tried to show her how to arrange some little pickup sandwiches on a tray. Then Lonnie said, all he said to her was, "I told you you should have hired a nigger." I said right out loud, "Lord God Almighty." I knew what Ruby'd come from by then, and I just wanted to grab her and tell her something, but I didn't feel like I could touch her. She just looked down at her feet, and she didn't say anything for a minute. Then she started giggling. Had to pure hold the dust rag up to her mouth to stop up the sound. I said, "What's so funny?" I sure didn't say anything funny. And she said, "Whoo! I just thought of Frances tasting one of those little lady fingers her sister brought and commenting on how she put in way, way too much salt. Then I say, maybe she ought to have something to wash it down, how it's a rat poison I sprinkled on top that brings out the salty flavor. And then Frances grabs at her throat and falls out." I thought Ruby lost her mind. I'd never heard of such from a woman, but that was before I knew how to take her. Sometimes she'd fool you, funny when she meant to be serious and the other way around. I got in hot water many a time not taking Ruby the way she wanted me to. Yes, I sure thought she was thinking about doing something to old Francis. That was also before she told me what she'd had lined up for John Woodrow. After then, I always said, "You better think twice before you step on Ruby's toes." I remember one time we were joking around having a good time, and I asked her, "What kind of punishment you got in mind for me if I step out of line?" And you know what she said? She said, "Oh, I'm gonna love you to pieces. Love you to death." How about that? Hear such as that for 25 years and see don't you miss it when it's gone. It's a cold, cold heart that wouldn't.
Jack came in the house, kissed me like I knew he would. Now he's gone again, gone down to the store to meet his pinball game. I should have gone with him, I usually do. I just didn't think it'd be much fun today, and even a short walk seems to ruin me lately. I wonder what Mama would have to say about me sitting here alone as I am, waiting for Jack's pinball game to break up, no friends to speak of except Burr and June, my brothers and their families. I bet she'd want to know if I could say I'm happy in spite of everything, living so far out here, being sick. She'd say, "Tell me, has there been a single ounce of good come from all you've been through?" I'd look around the house far as I can see from this kitchen table while Mama waits for an answer, and I'd show her Jack's old brogans in the corner by the broom, the picture of a snowman June made for me that Jack had framed, photographs I brought back when I went home for Daddy's funeral, especially the one of me holding my little prize Schubert bust at my 10-year recital, and I'd say, "Well, Mama, I do believe I am. In spite of everything, I do believe I've been happy." That John Woodrow time was something I went through to get where I am, and I can appreciate good now because of it. Surely that would satisfy her. June's been about as much reason for the good I felt as any other. All those times she'd run up to Jack and me. I couldn't count how many mornings we got up and found her sitting on our front porch swinging, waiting for us to start stirring. Saturdays, summer days, school holidays. She still comes to see us about every other weekend. I've been making some clothes for her to take on a cruise this winter. Jack and I had been married about 3 years with no babies when we figured something might really be wrong. It took us another year to decide to see a doctor, and then another year to get enough nerve to go. When we finally went and found out I wasn't likely ever to have a child, I think Jack and I more or less assumed possession of June. Burr knew what we were doing. It didn't bother him. I think he was glad for the help with her. A man must have a hard time looking after a girl. I'll never forget her coming here once when she was 12, crying, scared to death, absolutely no idea what had happened to her. I talked to her, explained things the best I could, and let her spend the rest of the afternoon here with me. Later on, I walked her back home, and I got Tiny Fran out on the porch and asked her why, for goodness sake, she hadn't talked to the girl about her body, why she at least hadn't gotten her some books to read. Tiny Fran told me it was none of my business, got pretty belligerent about it. We went around and around on the subject of her irresponsibility until I just gave up. By then I should have known better than to expect her to apologize for the past or change so the future would be different, better. But I went right back in the house and helped June pack an overnight bag, marched right past Tiny Fran with her, and brought her back here. Burr came over later that day, and after I told him what had happened, he gave June some money to buy a dress she'd had her eye on. I promised her we'd go to town and get it when Jack got home. Burr thanked me for looking after her, bringing her back with me. We were both surprised Tiny Fran let me take her without another fight, but you never really could predict her. Nobody predicted she'd leave him. We all thought she'd stay out there chipping away at everybody's peace of mind as long as she lived. If Tiny Fran felt pushed hard enough, she'd even say Jack and I brainwashed June. When June was small and Tiny Fran would say something like that with Burr present, he'd wear himself out trying to explain how ridiculous she was being. He'd bring up all those times she'd jumped all over June for no reason, humiliated her, and he'd come in from the fields to find June crying on the steps or shut up in her room. Then Burr got tired of listening to her and tired of running down his list, And when she'd get on one of her screaming jags, he'd just bring June to me and ask me to keep her until he could get Tiny Fran in order. And more nights than a few, Burr himself spent the night on our couch. Poor Burr was certainly caught between a rock and a hard place with his wife and the land her daddy gave him. And when the two children got caught in the middle, Roland was pushed to lie still and hurt anything he touched. And June, thank goodness, was pushed to me, straight across her daddy's field to me. It took everything Tiny Fran had to act civil towards me. And when she was, there was a catch to it, something behind it, like the time they needed to stay with her mother during an operation, and she called over here, cordial, friendly as she could be. I kept wanting to say, "Get to the point, Tiny Friend, go ahead and get to the point." And when she finally did, she told me she wanted to know if Jack and I could look after June and Roland the week she and Burr would be gone. I knew that by then she'd called everybody she knew, and they'd all said the same thing I was about to tell her. "June, fine, but I can't handle Roland. I just can't handle him. He was too wild. I couldn't control him." They ended up having to take Roland with them, leaving June here. She was 6 then. I can't think of anything in the world outside of a very good, very long dream to compare to that week with her. I've not had another one like it. We'd all get up in the morning, play, have lunch, play some more, eat dinner, play. I'd have to nudge Jack out of the door to go over to Burr's and keep things running, keep the help busy. He said he'd rather stay here with us and weave potholders, and I believed him. She slept in the back bedroom with Puppy. She'd sneak out of the pen out back and turn into the house. Jack would wake me in the middle of the night and tell me to go in there and look at the baby asleep in a bed full of dogs. When Burr came to get her, he came in the kitchen and sat down by her and asked if she'd had a good time. She wouldn't answer. I told her to tell her daddy what all we'd done, maybe show him some of the potholders we'd made. But she wouldn't speak. She wouldn't even look at him for rolling her fist around in her eyes, shuffling her feet, shrugging when he touched her. I told her she should be sweet and he'd let her come and stay again. But I knew how she felt. I didn't want to be sweet myself. Jack couldn't watch her go. When he'd seen Burr driving up in the yard, he went to the bathroom and told me to tell him he was tied up and would see him later that day. The next time June visited us, I took lots of pictures of her, and I kept on taking them. I'd stare at those pictures long enough to see what I wanted to, see her mind.
Burr told me last week, he said to me, "The years my wife's been gone have been the happiest years of my life." He said all he missed about her leaving was wishing she'd go. I told him it was a shame in this world he couldn't have had a woman like Ruby. And he just had to shake his head like, "I know." Tiny Fran left him right after June went off to college. I was out sweeping under the pony shelter, and he showed up and said to me, "Well, she left." He said they'd had a royal knockdown dragout over how much money he'd been mailing to June. And one thing led to another, and she got her suitcase out, and what she didn't cram into it, she threw at him. Then he asked her what she was going to live on, and she told him she'd borrow on or sell off her part of the farm, and that'd keep her fairly well. Burr said he thought, "Oh, hell no, you won't," and he went and got his checkbook and bought her out right there, wrote out something, and she signed it. I said, "Well, congratulations, let's take a drink." He said he could use one. He needed more than one, that's for damn sure. I told him I'd be interested to see how long the money held out. He said that'd depend on how many times she walked by a shoe store. And sure enough, last year about this time she called him and said she is in a bind, and every month since then, he's been sending her a check. Ruby told him it was the best investment he ever made, that maybe she'd fall in love with a shoe salesman. We all had to laugh. Ruby loved Burr and June, tolerated Tiny Fran, but pure couldn't stomach Roland. From the time Roland was born until the time they let him off away from out here, Tiny Fran stayed right on top of him like she was a hen and he was the damn egg. just raising all grades of hell if anybody came near him. You'd go up in the yard and she'd be hanging out to wash, him pulling on her skirt and whining, and you'd hear her saying, "Mama'll make you a big old cake soon as she's done." They'd sit down and split a chocolate cake, but she wouldn't have given June air if she was in a jug. June turned out, though. I and Burr and Ruby jumping in between her and Tiny Fran every time she tried to ruin her. She's an architect in town now. I still get to see her right much. You won't see Roland, though. He's in jail, they said, for at least 10 years, and I tell you what, I think it ought to be 1,000 years. Listen and let me tell you what else I think about it. Listen to how God is up there supposed to make everything and everybody, and everything's due to turn out according to his will and all. And we get the wars and the people starving and people hurting people and animals the way Roland did, and I'm supposed to go down there to Ephesus on a Sunday morning and say, "Thank you, Jesus. Thank you for the sunshine and the food on my table and all the birds singing and the likes of Adolf Hitler and Roland Stanley. No, thank you. I'll have no part of it. I think about that and want to tell it to Cecil Spangler and every other gung-ho Christian that's been out here trying to save me. And then I'd say, think about that, O ye of all that faith." More than one time when Tiny Franz heard me comment on the way she handled her children, especially Roland, she'd say, "How come you can profess to know so much and you and Ruby can't even have any babies? Who made you the expert?" I used to tell her I and Ruby had the instinct for it, whereas she'd be better off with billy goats and guinea pigs. Burr used to hear us going at it like that and laugh his head off. Tiny Fran was known for showing her tail, but she couldn't just show it, then you'd laugh, and that'd be all until the next time she'd do something ignorant. No, half the time she'd fairly well stun you with something so ugly you'd have to say to yourself, "I cannot believe that came out of a human being." Like at the beach one time, like with Ruby this summer, be 18 years ago. It was hot in summer like it is now, and Burr came over here late in the day and asked me why I and Ruby didn't ride to the coast with him the next weekend. He said Tiny Fran threw a natural-born fit over the idea, but June threw a bigger one over the idea of us not, and you can bet which one Burr went along with. I told him we'd go, long as Tiny Fran stayed away from Ruby and didn't bother. He said he'd do his best to keep the lid on her. We went all crammed into Burr's car, and before we'd backed out of the driveway, I wished we'd put Roland in the damn trunk. I know he was just 6, and you're supposed to make an allowance for them that young, but you tell that to somebody that's not shut up in a car with a damn demon child and his mama. When we got going, Ruby kept trying to be friendly and pleasant, talking about how nice it was to be going to the beach and so forth and so on. I can still see her riding the whole way with a pineapple cake between her feet and holding a pound cake. Then it started to be every single time Ruby'd open her mouth to say something, Tiny Fran had cut in. Irked me so bad. Finally, Bert told her to let Ruby finish a sentence. That made her so mad she twisted and got herself up on one thigh and rode the rest of the trip with everything pushed into the door, looking like she was looking out the window. The rest of the way, Tiny Fran sucked her breaths in and blew them out like she was having to strain for air, huffing and puffing, hot with all of us. Then Bert told her just to keep on like that and she'd have a real fine time that weekend if she didn't make herself pass out before we got there. Then she told him to go to hell, said that applied to everybody. We finally got there and we pulled up at the Pettigrew's cottages. I remember it was Pettigrew's because I couldn't imagine somebody being named something-something Pettigrew. I can't picture a Pettigrew. And Lord, was it hot. Hotter than 40 hells, not enough breeze to do any good. After we got everything unloaded and inside, Bird told me to let's get the fishing mess ready and go buy some bait and go on out. Then listen and tell me if you hear something funny. Tiny Fran broke in and asked him where he'd put the folding chairs. And Burr said, what? And she said, you know, my brand new folding chairs I got especially for this trip. Burr told her he didn't remember packing or unpacking them, and he went on about his business. Then she got hot. She yelled at him, well, what do you expect me to sit on? Then listen, he said, I guess you can sit down on your fist and lean back on your thumb. I laughed, and Ruby laughed, and I thought Burr was going to choke. He laughed so hard. Tiny Fran told us all to go to hell and went on inside. Then we all went out to see the water. Stayed out there about all afternoon. I wore some Bermuda shorts Ruby got me when she bought her bathing suit. I said she could take the matched T-shirt back to the store. She'd gotten an idea I'd look good in red, but I told her to take it on back. I'd wear an undershirt. You ought to have seen Ruby. She was the one who looked like something in red. Red top with a blue bottom, two-pieced. She is only 27 then, and her skin still snapped back like a rubber band. Tiny Fran getting into her feed sack of a bathing suit must have been like cramming mud in a glove. Well, when the sun was cooling down, Burr said he guessed we'd all better get on back up to the house, that the children looked about played out, and he knew Ruby must be tired of chasing them. Then he called out and asked Tiny Fran what she had on the menu. She looked up, looked like a turtle pulling his head up, and she said she's on vacation and that folks could fend for themselves tonight. He told her, he said, if you can't find the energy to cook, then I guess you can't get fixed up to go out somewhere either. You just lay around here and we'll tell you how good it was. She told him to go on and leave her alone, and she heaved herself up on one side and plopped over to get some sunshine on that big white stomach of hers. That was one woman that had no business in a bathing suit. But we all went in and left her out there baking, and not more than 15 minutes later, here she comes, stomping across the sand dunes, scared to death she might miss a meal. She walked right by us all on the porch. Took Roland inside with her, though. He had an earful to give her about June throwing sand on him, and when I heard it, I thought bullshit, it was the other way around. We could hear him whining to her inside there, and Ruby just tried to talk over it, telling June how she ought to wear this or that pretty outfit to the restaurant. Then we all went in, sat around talking, and Ruby said, where's June? I thought she was still out on the porch, but Ruby looked out the door and said, no, she's not on the porch. Then we heard it, sounding like somebody was pure cutting somebody open back there. And then you heard Tiny Fran say, June, you give that horn back to him right this damn minute. And then you heard June say, I had it first. And then here comes June tearing down the hall with a plastic trumpet in her mouth, running I know straight for Ruby. And then here comes Roland behind her, and he tackles her from behind, and there goes June. Tiny Fran came behind Roland and yelled at June. She said, I told you to give that baby his horn. That baby, and him 2 years older than her. But there June was, face down, and just gagging and gurgling, and Ruby went and bent down beside her, turned her over, and took and used her skirt to get the blood off her face. She told Burr to get some ice real quick, and then she looked in June's mouth and said the blood probably made it look worse than it was, but she ought to go to the emergency room anyway. Then Tiny Fran told Roland to go back in the bedroom, and she got right next to Ruby. Ruby still wiping blood and trying to calm June down, and she said, move. Get your goddamn claws off her. It came out roaring. Scared Ruby so bad she started shaking. I told her to shut her nasty mouth or I'd show her the back of my hand. She told me I was the one that needed to shut up, and then Ruby said we didn't need a fight and all. Burr came in with the ice and told Tiny Fran to straighten up and go pull the car around. And when she did, I and Burr laid June in the back seat, and him and her and Roland took her to the hospital. I'd have said we wanted to go, but I figured we weren't family, and Ruby'd been made to feel in the way enough for one day. Ruby went in a bedroom and laid across a bed. I stood in the door watching her. She told me to come on in and lay down, that the bed was cool, and it was finally a breeze starting to blow in the window. I did, and then she told me to hold her real tight from the back. We laid there until way after it got dark, and she cried most of the time. I knew Ruby. I knew she was crying for babies she wished had been born to us, ones I couldn't give her. And as ignorant a man as I am, I knew what I was hearing. I knew the sound of Ruby crying for babies the way I know a robin's call. I thought about getting an orphan, like asking Ruth Hartley if we could take and raise one of the little girls she was bringing up. But when I saw how June was taken up with Ruby, I decided to wait and see if she couldn't fill in. She never did all the way, but she did some. I really didn't want to try out for an orphan. All Ruby would have needed would have been for the state to tell her I wasn't right, not enough money or sense to trust a child with. I sit here acting like if I and Ruby had had a child, it had turned out like June. Good, smart, but that's an awful lot to pretend like what might would could have happened. I know everybody that wants a child sits around and thinks up a good boy or girl skipping rope, licking an ice cream cone. No, you're going to get some bad. You just don't want to be the one that gets stuck raising it. Somebody bad like Roland. All he's ever after is wanting to watch somebody suffer, like the way he made Ruby and her anniversary mule suffer. I remember when his mess finally caught up with him and they put him in the jailhouse, I thought they ought to do the same thing to him he did to the mule. You'll never hear of such as what happened to Sugar Pete. It was one weekend I and Ruby left here and went to the mountains to visit Jimmy and his wife and her other brother Paul. Before we left, I went over yonder and asked Burr if he'd look after things around here, feed up, keep the mail picked up, and he said he would, so I said we'd go on then. We went and had a good time, and when we got home, the first thing I and Ruby did was to go out to the pony barn and check on her mule. I'd just given it to her for her anniversary because she'd said she wanted something to ride on along beside me when I take a pony down the path. Something slow she felt like wouldn't get out from under. So I got her a mule, and she is tickled. But that Sunday morning late, we walked out to the pony barn and went under the shelter, and I had to holler, "Don't look, Ruby. Stay back." But she looked in, looked up at him swinging, all swole, and she just had to sit down on the feed box and cry. I felt like I pure had to hit somebody. I said, "I know who did it. He can't hide. God damn you, Roland Stanley." Ruby told me I ought not to swear at Roland like that unless I knew for sure he is the one did it. She wanted to know how I didn't know it wasn't some of the Mexican boys Luther Snipes had picking cucumbers. I said to her, "Ruby, you don't know people like I do." I said, "Mexicans would have drove up out here drunk, took Sugar Pete for a little ride up and down the path, put her back, and wouldn't have left a thing to tell it by but beer bottles." I told her a mean, wild-ass boy like Roland that ought to know better is the kind that'll hang a mule. Then she wanted to know what we ought to do next, and I told her just go on back to the house and let me take care of it. And I did. I went right across the field to Burr's house and went right on in the door, and I told them all sitting around the supper table, I said, "Your goddamn boy hung my mule." Tiny Fran almost swallowed her tongue. I told her to shut up before she said anything, and then I said, "You heard me. Your boy hung my mule, and I want to know where he is so I can kill the son of a bitch." I went on and told him I knew it was him on account of how I'd walked up on him and two of the Snipes boys teasing Sugar Pete about a week before, talking about how stupid she looked, poking at her, and how I told them I'd get my pistol out if they didn't get on back down the road. Tiny Fran wanted to try to say something again, and Burr told her to just stay out of it, that it was I and his business. Then Burr got up from the table and said to go with him back to the living room and we'd talk about it. Then he told me he felt like the whole business was partway his fault for how he'd sent Roland over to my house to feed up in his place that Saturday evening. They'd called a Grange meeting he had to go to. And then he said it wasn't a doubt in his mind that Roland was a ringleader, that it was pure evil and had his name all over it. I know Burr felt real bad. He said he'd try and make it right. We went on back in the kitchen, and Tiny Fran was slamming dishes in the sink. And Burr went over to the china closet and got me a $100 bill out of a little pitcher. He told me to take it and buy Ruby another mule. He even said he'd take me to the stockyard on sale day to help me find a good one. But before the bill hit my hand, Tiny Fran swung around from the sink and yelled out, I was saving that money for a dishwasher. Burr just went on and put the money in my hand and listened to me. He said, Woman, you got two perfectly good dishwashers, the right hand and the left one. She said a few choice words and headed out the door. I had to laugh, although I hated to in the middle of this about Sugar Pete. June got up from the table and said she was going to see Ruby, and Burr said to go on and see her. I look back on it now and feature myself slamming Tiny Fran back into a chair just like she was slamming those dishes, and I tell her, listen here, you knew when you had him he was a goddamn monster, you bound to. A mama ought to know. If I was you, I'd have been punching him in the goddamn mouth every time he opened it to speak the past 16 years. Leastways, he shouldn't have been out, mean as he is, out around in somebody's business. If I had a rattlesnake, I'd keep him locked up in a glass box, where folks can tap and tap all they want to and not have to worry about getting bit. Same thing with your little bastard. I bought another mule with Burr's money. We called him Sugar Pete after the first one. He had a strong back and nice curve to him, and eyes, Ruby said, looked full of sense. We had a good time with him. But to tell the truth, you couldn't hardly look at him and not think of the first Sugar Pete. And after Ruby died, I couldn't hardly bear to look at him. I sold him to a boy up the road here. You hate to do it, but you have to. Leastways, neither. I don't have to look at Roland. I hope they threw away the damn key. I know Stella Morgan wasn't an ivory girl, but she didn't deserve what he did to her. People won't say much about it, never did, but I guarantee if it'd been a black boy that did it, the KKK and the rights of white people nuts would have been out here marching and raising all grades of hell up and down the highway. It's not that Burr tried to cover it up or protect Roland from it being publicized. He wouldn't even pay for him a lawyer. One of Tiny Fran's gripes was if they'd got him somebody down here from New York City, he'd have gone free. I wanted to tell her bullshit. Perry Mason working Della Street and Paul Drake overtime couldn't have defended that boy. And the stupidest part of it all was he raped Stella Morgan while he's on probation for something he'd done almost as disgusting. Listen and tell me if you don't hear something that won't turn your stomach. Roland was 18 years old, about to get out of school, and Burr sent him to the FCX to get something, and instead of going and doing what he was supposed to do, he went and did something else. He went in a nice new big department store downtown and got a pair of scissors and had himself a little party, cut the crotches out from between the legs of some nice ladies' drawers. Burr was in a state of shock when the sheriff called and said what he had Roland locked up for. I was ashamed to tell Ruby. Then all they did was make him see a doctor, and then the doctor said Roland wasn't so messed up he couldn't live amongst the rest of us, so they put him on probation and told him to do so many hours of community service. You want to hear Roland's idea of serving the community? He got a date with Stella when she was living at Ruth Hartley's, and he got her shut up in Burr's car and near about beat the life out of her. Ellen, one of the girls that stayed up at Ruth's with her, told Ruby how late one night they heard something sounded like all hell breaking loose in front of the house, then a car door slamming, then tires squalling, and Ellen said she got to the front door and looked out and saw Burr's car tearing up down the highway. She said she thought, "Where's Stella?" Then she thought, "That sorry Roland Stanley." She said she could see Stella, looking like something off a monster movie with that full moon hitting her beat-up face, trying to pull herself up off the ditch bank. Her and Ruth took her to town, and soon as they got her checked in the emergency room, she got hold of the sheriff and told about seeing Burr's taillights. And to top the whole thing off, he went and did the one thing it couldn't anybody forgive him for, if you could ever excuse him for Stella. He left her there at Ruth's and went right on home and went to bed, like he was daring somebody to come in and accuse him, like he was a goddamn Boy Scout or something. I think if he'd have run just a little ways, people wouldn't despise him as much as they do. See, him playing big man with the law was too big an insult to people out here. He ought to have run some. But he let the sheriff walk right in his room and get him. Won't no chasing or